It is with great pleasure that I take now to introduce our speaker for the evening, Jack Kay from Los Angeles.
I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. My name is Jack Kissel. Member of the Thursday night West Hollywood discussion group. And I want to thank the committee for giving me the privilege to be here this evening. I crawled out of an alley 11 years ago to get here. I have a statistically slightly different story than most of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. 80% of us, according to statistics, had a period of time in their life when they were indistinguishable from social drinkers. Many of us, that lasted a long time. I have one friend who got sober when he was 70, and he's now 82 and doing fine. And so most of us do have that period of time, varying in length. In my case, if I did any social drinking, it was for about an hour and a half one night in May in 1946, and that was the end of that. It just got off and running pretty fast. As it turns out, in retrospect, I was behaving like an alcoholic before I ever got to alcohol. I found that out after I got in here and started listening to people sharing their stories. I took my first geographic when I was 13, and I hadn't really done a lot of drinking yet. I stole a little wine as an altar boy and a few minor things, but nothing, you know, nothing serious. But I had decided by then that my problem was my father, who was an alcoholic, and I decided in my devious and cunning fashion to run away from home without anybody knowing I was doing it. And if you're Irish Catholic in South Bend, Indiana, there is no more socially acceptable way to leave home than to go study to be a priest at Notre Dame. So that's what I did. And I got out there, and I was there about 6 months, and it dawned on me that I didn't feel any different than I had at home. At home, my earliest memory was feelings of being lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid. And I was out there in the seminary about 6 months, and I discovered that I felt lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid. I hadn't fixed it. And I realized I'd made a terrible mistake, because my parents were very pleased that I was in the seminary. With their oldest son, a priest, they figured they had a free ticket to heaven. And so I faked it for 2 more years until I got up the courage to leave. And then I came home at 16, and I felt like a failure. I had failed God as I understood him at the time, and I failed myself in a little goal I had set for me, you know, to become a priest. And then also I had canceled my parents' free ticket to heaven. So it was tough. The night after I got home, I was 16, it was May in 1946, some of the guys who had been in regular high school, out of generosity and I imagine a certain degree of curiosity, invited me to go out with them. I think they wanted to see, you know, what this was like, because for 2.5 years I'd been out there practicing 20 hours of silence a day, from the ages of 14 through 16, trying not to think about girls, you know. So we went out, 5 of us, and we didn't even buy a whole case of beer, so there wasn't a lot to drink. But that night that's when I did my hour and a half of social drinking, and then some of the symptoms of my disease developed that very first night. One of my symptoms is bad judgment. And if you're my size, belligerence is bad judgment, let me tell you. And I was belligerent that night and most nights thereafter. And in addition just to being belligerent, I also had the bad judgment to choose a guy to pick on particularly who had, while I was gone out there, He had become an all-state halfback. I didn't know that. And he beat me up that night. 3 times because I didn't get the message the first 2 times. And then in that same evening, I had what I now know to be an alcoholic rage. And then it took 3 guys to subdue old 5'5 and 120, you know, because I just got maniacal. I wanted to kill somebody. And the 3 of them subdued me. And they got me in the back of a car and laid me on the floor. And 2 guys sat in the back seat and held me to the floor with their feet. And a 3rd one drove me home. And on the way home, I experienced a personality change. I just became warm and wonderful. And I started to cry. And I threw up on his floor. And they dragged me out of the car at my house and helped me up the front steps and leaned me against the front door of my house like a thing and pushed the doorbell and ran because they didn't want to deal with my father. And my father opened the door, and here was his oldest son, 16, ex-seminarian by 1 day, drunk. And Dad was a practicing alcoholic at the time. He did the only thing he knew how to do. He punched me out. That was my first night of serious drinking. And I loved it, man. I loved it. I never skipped a drink to the best of my ability for the next 24 and a half years. I also, during that evening, one or two Al-Anons I know in the room, I experienced a phenomenon that many of us have gone through called a blackout. And since at least the Al-Anons have never experienced that, I think it's only fair that I tell you what it feels like. It's a period of time, at least in my case, ranging anywhere from a half an hour to 5 days, during which I was very active and not present. I mean, that's just how it felt. I had my first blackout that evening, and I also ran into a little phenomenon that I found many people very willing to do. They were able to fill me in on the hour and a half that I wasn't present for, you know. I later on married somebody who was very good at doing that. It's a little game that many of us married alcoholics have played called, "Do you know what you did last night?" At first I used to say, "Of course I do," you know, and then I knew that she knew, and so then I finally admitted that I didn't. And her program wasn't all that honest then either, because after a few years with me, she began to add things that I hadn't done. But I didn't know the difference, so I took the blame for all of it, you know. And I had that experience that first night, and the next day there was a guy very willing to tell me what had gone on during the hour and a half when I had not been present. So that's how it started for me, and it didn't get any better. The price of my drinking went up rather rapidly. Like many of our fellowship, I loved the line that is often quoted at meetings during the seventh tradition when they say we have no dues or fees, because I know very well I've paid my dues. You know, I paid them. When I was 17, after having been drinking for 6 months, I was at a coroner's inquest for involuntary manslaughter. And the price of my drinking went up very fast. I was acquitted of that charge. They didn't indict me. And the reason for that was that I lied. And the little girl who had been with me in the car lied. And a deputy sheriff, St. Joe County in Indiana, lied. And he perjured himself at that inquest because he was trying to give me a break. I was 17 from a poor family, and I had won a scholarship to the university, and he didn't want to spoil the career of a promising young man. I was able, in the course of my years of drinking, to find a lot of people who would help me evade the responsibilities of my actions, people who would let me slide one more time, give me another chance. It happened numerous times in my drinking career, and it was always pretty much the same. I got out of that deal. I'd been in a blackout when the incident occurred. My mother woke me when I was 17 one morning and said, "Dad," she said, "Jack, the man died, and they want to see you this afternoon at the courthouse." And It was a terrible experience for me. And when I was acquitted that afternoon, I celebrated by getting drunk. I didn't know what else to do. But I also made a vow. I said that this will never happen to me again. I am going to turn my life around. And I went out to the university with great ambition and high aspiration, determined that my life would be different from now on. That was just a bad break that I had to overcome. And that's when the Jekyll and Hyde part of my life began. Because I really did try when I went to school. I studied harder than I had before. And the one side of me, which the book refers to as the Jekyll aspect of this alcoholic, you know, did pretty well. I won a national award for poetry. I got pretty well known on campus for legal extracurricular activities, and did okay. In those same 4 years, while I was, you know, relatively successful at school, I was also arrested for inciting a riot, for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. I attempted suicide in some fashion three times during my 4 years. They were not exactly attempts to do away with myself. Let me explain. What I was doing, those suicide efforts, were really vignettes that I would stage to show the world how badly the world was treating me, you know? I give you one example. Is there was a time when we were driving back from Niles, Michigan, having closed the bars. They stayed open later over there. And the guy that was driving was going 85 miles an hour down the Dixie Highway, and I decided to throw myself out into traffic. And I threw open the passenger door and started to roll out into traffic slowly enough so that somebody could save me, you know. I didn't want to get hurt. And that was the way my suicides were. So by the time I was about to graduate, I realized that there was something seriously the matter with me. I decided that it was psychiatric in nature, and with my devious alcoholic personality, what I did was decide that I needed psychiatric help, and I was going to get it without anybody knowing that I was doing it, including the psychiatrist. And the way I figured that out is I got myself drafted, and I had been an English major, nothing to do with medicine, and assigned to the medics, and then assigned to psychiatric social work, where I could be trained by the government at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio in psychology so I could find out what the hell was the matter with me. And I went through that course successfully. I managed to be second in the class upon graduation, but I didn't learn what was the matter with me because other symptoms of my disease had developed. Channel hearing and tunnel vision. And when they got to that section in our training about alcoholism, I sat there in class and tuned them out. I just didn't hear that part. I knew whatever they had to teach about neurosis and psychosis and character disorders, but I skipped the part on alcoholism and just kept on going. By then, I had added some other chemicals to my recipe. I started smoking grass long before it was a social movement. I added grass in 1953 to the booze. Eventually, I added benzedrine to the grass and the booze, and then I added cocaine to the benzedrine and the grass and the booze, and then I added uppers and downers to the benzedrine and the cocaine and the grass and the booze, and then I added heroin to the cocaine and the uppers and the downers and the benzedrine and the cocaine and the grass and the booze, and then I added psychedelics for religious reasons. You know, isn't that why you did? If you could just get right with the cosmos, everything would be all right, you know. I got out there and wasn't sure I was ever going to come back. But in 1953, behaving like that and drinking and smoking my brains out to oblivion every night, in fact, that was my cocktail. Here's to oblivion, boom! And that was my condition. And for a year and a half in that condition, every morning I went out to Fort Ord, California and counseled neurotics. And, you know, oddly enough, I was some help to some of those people. as long as their problem wasn't booze. I mean, I had learned a little bit about the other things, and I would help them and listen to them, and I cared about them, and I really did try. If their problem happened to be drinking, I would listen carefully and say, I don't see your problem. I drink more than that. You know, so that's how that was. So when I got out of the Army, I realized that California psychology and discipline had not helped me. And so I diagnosed my problem again. I decided that it wasn't psychiatric in nature. My real problem, I then discovered, was that I was just too capricious, too free-spirited, too wild, too sensitive for this world. And I figured that I prescribed for me that what I needed was some stability. So I went to New York City, and a month after I got there, I found a good woman. And she had a little three-year-old girl by a previous marriage, and that fitted my prescription exactly. See, it was an instant family, and that would give me responsibility. And then I would settle down, and everything would be all right. And that's when Gene got hooked into my disease. Now, my wife is here, and she's been with me for 28 years, and she is not an alcoholic. I know that. It almost killed me to find it out. I was able to see that she was a little unusual very soon after we met. I took her with me one night, I mean, I don't think we were together a month, to a party. And she did the strangest thing. We went to this party, and we weren't there a half an hour, and Jean forgot where her drink was. Man, I never did that in my entire life. I knew where your drink was. I thought that was a little strange of her, you know. And then, later on, I think it was the same evening, she said, the darndest, I said to her, I just happened to be going to the bar. Do you want another drink? And she said, no, I've had enough. There isn't enough. If the Pacific Ocean were Kentucky bourbon, I would worry about evaporation. You know, there ain't enough. I thought, what a strange thing to say. So I got my own drink, and I think probably even that same evening, I also, later on, I said, I happened to be going back to the bar. Do you want a drink? And she said, no, I don't want one. Well, I knew she was lying. But I admired her self-control. It really impressed me. In fact, it is one of the reasons that I have been able to discover how my self-esteem began to slip. Just that simple little thing of her saying, I don't want one. Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, states as the unifying characteristic of all alcoholics is the fact that when they take a drink, they want another one. That's all. It is not your rap sheet. It's not your list of jobs, number of marriages, how many jails or mental institutions. The unifying thing that all alcoholics have in common is that when we take a drink, we want another one. Now, I've known some people who were able to take a drink or two and not take another one. That doesn't make them non-alcoholics. That's why I believe Dr. Silkworth also said it was a self-diagnostic disease. Only I know if, when I take a drink, I want another one. Well, I figured she was lying, because I didn't know until I was sober 3 or 4 months and Jean was in Al-Anon, it never dawned on me that her self-control, that wonderful strength of character that she had exhibited to me all those years, when she was able to refrain from having a 12th drink, you know, wasn't really all that admirable. I discovered when I was about 3 or 4 months sober that when my wife takes a drink, it just lays there. It doesn't do much for her. Now, when I take a drink, there is a soft explosion inside of me, cools me off, mellows me out, and indicates to me that everything is going to be all right. Right after that, things generally turn to poo-poo. But I don't care by then, you know. And I figured that she had this marvelous self-restraint. And I admired her secretly. I admired her tremendously. And my self-esteem continued to erode as she was able to exhibit this willpower, you know. And it's hard to live like that. It's not easy. And she didn't stay quite as understanding as she had been in the early days. Because soon after we'd been together a little while, instead of saying, "I've had enough," she used to add, "And you've had enough." You know, I don't want to hear that. I'll be the decider of that. And I was never apologetic about my drinking. I never have been, you know. In fact, she'd say to me, "You've had enough," and I'd say, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about." And she said, "Well, you're drunk." And I said, "Yeah, but I'm still conscious, you know. And if I pass out and you're a friend of mine, wake me up and pour me one, you know. I mean, I don't want to miss the party." So I never did apologize, even when things got a lot worse. And denial, as you know, is one of our symptoms, but it's one of theirs, too. She was marvelous at denial. After a while, I think she was better at denial than I. I remember an incident one time, I think it was when we were in Ohio, I drove up onto the front lawn about 2:30 in the morning and fell out of the car, and I crawled across the front lawn up the front steps, and I was able to locate the front door key, and then I couldn't find the front door. And she threw it open and looked down at me and said, "Have you been drinking?" I looked up at her and said, "God, I hope so, you know, I mean, have you been breathing? I've been drinking, I mean, come on, what else do you want to talk about?" So I did never apologize for my drinking. I don't want to lead you to the idea that I never apologized. I apologized all the time. I began apologizing early on. I was apologizing to that judge at 17. I apologized for my behavior constantly, over and over. I apologized to judges, to jailers, to policemen, to my wife, to my mother, to my father, to my children, to a variety of bosses and boards of directors and everybody I could. Eventually, just before I got to AA, I was apologizing to total strangers on the street. I mean, somebody passed me by and I said, "I'm sorry," you know. And I was. I was sorry to be occupying your world. I was sorry to be breathing your air. I didn't belong here. I couldn't find where I did, but it wasn't here. And so I just stumbled around apologizing because I didn't belong. I have a friend, God love her, used to say when she was new in AA, we had one meeting in Los Angeles about the size of this meeting, and she said she always had the feeling when she got there that everybody else came in the same bus, and she came alone, you know. And I felt like that about the whole world. You all knew each other, you know, you just didn't know me. And there was a book that came out a few years ago, and I just loved the title because it was my inner life. The book was called, What Do You Say After You Say Hello? And I didn't know. I used to eavesdrop all the time, listening to what you said to each other. And then I would imitate it. So I was just reading your lines because I didn't know how to behave. I didn't know how to act. I couldn't feel a part of anything or any place. And that's the way it was. And it was like that before I got to booze. And it was like that while I was drinking. Booze helped me, but it didn't solve the problem. Because when I drank, I didn't become a part of, I became the leader of the gang. I mean, that's all it did for me. I just took over. But I never felt a part of, and it was like that after I got sober, too, for a while. I don't know exactly when I joined the Fellowship of the Spirit, but when it happened, it was an incredible experience, because I'm never alone. I never feel alone. When I'm alone, I'm not alone. I'm a part of. It feels like that today, and it sure didn't for many, many years. So Jean joined my problem. She's not an alcoholic, clearly not an alcoholic, and decided that she was going to help me get well. She diagnosed my problem the same way I did, lack of responsibility. And so she decided to help me get some by having children. She had been told that it was life-endangering for her to get pregnant because she couldn't carry to term. But she was determined and hadn't found Al-Anon yet. So she had 6 miscarriages and then my son John. Now, those miscarriages made me nervous, and when I get nervous, I drink. So the more pregnant she got, the drunker I got. Finally, we had John, and it hadn't made me any better. It made me worse. So she then said the problem was that I needed a little girl of my own. So she had 3 miscarriages and then my daughter, Christy. And by then, I was pretty sick. And we actually had a 4th child, which Jean insists she had given up the motive of making me well by giving me children. And she says that Mindy was for fun and for free, and I guess she was, you know. So we had children, and I got worse. And that was the period of time when I began to have changes of careers. At least that's what I called it. What, of course, it was is losing jobs and finding another one. But for a long while, I masqueraded that from everybody, including me, because it looked like I was just changing careers. I went from an unemployed actor in New York to an employed high school teacher. And I had a lot of trouble in New York City, and so when we moved to New Rochelle for me to take over as a high school teacher, I went there with great ambition and high aspiration, determined to turn my life around. And I got to be the most popular teacher in that school, especially with this one little group, because I was their connection. But I'm talking about the general population, too. But other symptoms of my disease had developed by then. Defiance and rebellion. Don't tell me what to do. You know, I just can't follow your rules. And so I had become defiant and arrogant and rebellious. And at the end of 3 years at that school, you're supposed to have a master's degree or you can't stay to get tenure. And by then I had been to graduate school at Columbia and at Fordham, and I had graduated from Notre Dame. So all I actually needed to complete the master's was to go to class one night a week for 1 semester, complete the requirements, they give me the degree. And I wouldn't do it. I figured, to hell with them. If they want me so badly, just change the rules. That's all you got to do. Now, by then, another one of the symptoms of my disease had developed. I didn't recognize it, of course, then, but have found out since I've been sober. See, lack of power is my dilemma. And in the course of my drinking, that lack of power began to exert itself in me, and I began to look for power. I began to try to exert power. And in that instance, I set myself against the Board of Education at New Rochelle, New York. And I was determined to bring that Board of Education to its knees. And I organized the kids in the high school, and they picketed on my behalf. And the PTA petitioned the board on my behalf. And the local newspaper ran a banner headline editorial attacking the Board of Education for its decision to let me go. And they decided to stick to the rules and drop me. I couldn't believe it. I lost that battle. I couldn't believe it. So we had to move on, left that job. Next thing I decided to do was form a regional theater with an ex-movie star. I noticed at the time that she didn't drink. I thought that was kind of strange. I didn't usually trust people that didn't drink. But I needed her power and influence, so I brought her along. I've talked to her recently. She hasn't had a drink for about 25 years. But I didn't know that then. And so she and I got together and picked a board of directors and set out to form a professional repertory theater. We raised $85,000 in the first year and never did a play. There is another name for that. Fortunately for me, the board of directors that I had hand-picked never did trust me, and so they kept the money in escrow that had been contributed to us, and at the end of the year, they fired me, disbanded the theater, and gave the money back. Or I would probably have found you under different circumstances, you know. So I was out of a job. I didn't know what to do, and I by then had diagnosed my problem a little differently. I now realized that my problem was that I had too much responsibility. Those four children and that wife, I mean, it was too much, and I needed to get rid of them. So I had decided to abandon my wife and children without anybody knowing I was doing it. And so the way I did that was get a job in Ohio, and I told Gene that I would go out there ahead of time and get things squared away and find a place to live and so on, and I'd send for them, and I never intended to see them again. And an interesting thing about that is, years later when we both got to the program, we discovered that she had decided to leave me and didn't tell me either. We abandoned each other forever without telling each other. Shows you how good our communication was. I went out to Ohio. It was the first time in my life, I was 33, that I'd ever had the opportunity to drink without somebody looking over my shoulder. You know, my mother, my father, the college, the army, my wife, the kids. And now I was alone, and I could drink like I had always intended, like a gentleman. And at the end of 6 weeks, I was dying. So I called my wife in New York. Now, I'd already learned how to manipulate her perfectly. If you ever decide you want to go back to manipulating your wife, and she's been with you any length of time and needs the program around and hasn't gotten there yet, I'll tell you how to do it. It only takes three words. I called her, and I said those three powerful words I know. I said, "I need you." She sold the furniture, packed up the four kids and the dog, and came out to Ohio to take care of me. Now, I was really grateful that they were coming back. I mean, they didn't know it, but I had abandoned them forever 6 weeks ago, you know. And so I was relieved and delighted they were coming back. And I tell this little incident so that I won't forget it. It's not a dramatic thing particularly, but it exemplifies for me what booze did to me so much of my life. I was delighted that family of mine were returning. And I had found a beautiful house for us and had rented it, and I put flowers in every room. I've always been a little grandiose. And got all dressed up and went very early so that I could meet them at the train. And I stopped at the Milano Club for lunch. Yeah, you got it. I went in there and I had a little cocktail before lunch. Every gentleman does. And there was a guy there that I knew, and he bought me a drink, and I bought him one. And then another fellow came in, and he bought a round. And then I bought a round, and another guy bought a round. And before you know it, the conversation became so engrossing that I forgot to meet my family at the train station. Now, I meant to be there, just as I had intended to be at the birth of each of my three children. I never was, but I meant to be. It's just that those births made me nervous, and when I get nervous, I drink. And then I don't know what I'm going to do. So somewhere in the middle of the afternoon, I suddenly said, "What time is it?" I said, "Well, it's about 3 o'clock. I said, "Oh, my God." And I raced across town to the train station, and by then my wife and children had been met by strangers who knew me and had been taken to the house that I had found. And so I raced across town to the house, and Jean opened the door, and I explained to her how an urgent business matter had arisen, and that it was just impossible for me to be there. And she said, "I understand." And I knew that she knew. And she knew that I knew. But we didn't know what else to do. So we lied to each other and kept on going. I lost that job at the end of 2 years out of arrogance. I'm hostile, irresponsible, arrogant, and I was extremely successful as far as their business was concerned. But the board of directors decided to settle for a little less success and a little peace and quiet. And so they fired me. Now by then I had added all those chemicals that I listed for you. My hair hung down to my shoulders. I had a Fu Manchu mustache and I was trying to grow a beard. And I got the best job of my life. It was a job that I needed desperately. When you have the lack of self-esteem that I have, you desperately need the esteem of others. You desperately need somebody else's approval because you have none of your own. And I was given a job with the right kind of prestige. I was made professor at a university and head of the department. And also by then I was a tad weird. But I went out to that university with great ambition and high aspiration, determined to turn my life around. And in some ways I did. When I got there, there were two people majoring in my discipline. When they fired me 2 years later, there were 90 people majoring in my discipline. And we had won competitive awards against every other college in that state. But the Hyde part of me had also become an active militant revolutionary, and I organized 26 kids on campus, and we were planning to blow up the administration building. That is not the way to find job security, let me tell you. And I needed the job! I needed the job! But I just couldn't resist my rebellion and my defiance. And I masked it under the guise of social conscience. I masked my rage and my rebellion under socially acceptable, at least to me, socially acceptable motives. It took me a while, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, to recognize that I didn't give a damn about the downtrodden or the blacks. That I cared about Jack and power. Because lack of power is my dilemma. And I will do anything to get it. I was determined to bring that university to its knees. And I did. Stopped all classes for 3 days. They surrounded my house. When my wife went to the grocery store, she was followed by a deputy sheriff's car. My children huddled away from the windows in our house. We had our meetings in my front room. My wife, who had not yet found Al-Anon, tried to calm us down by serving a lot of cookies. Now, we were all snorting stuff, man. "Yeah, I'll have some more of those." He didn't know what was going. I also, at that time, lack of power is my dilemma, was desperate to find power, and I made friends with gangsters. I had friends who hurt people for a living. If you hurt my feelings one night in a bar, a couple weeks later, somebody liable to come up and hurt you. And you never knew it came from me, and it felt like power. And what it was terror. So when they fired me from that job, the four kids and Gene and I got together in our
little front room in our little house in Ohio and tried to figure out what to do next. I had used up the East Coast, and I had just used up the Midwest. There wasn't a whole hell of a lot of choice. Christie says the reason they all wanted to come out to California is they were hoping maybe the sun would dry him up. But the sun did not dry me up. I spent 3 years of absolute hell. By then, I had made it impossible for me to work. The only thing I had left as far as earning a living, I was able to do this successfully. I got the want ads and found a couple of likely jobs for Jean. And then I drove her to the interviews and helped her prepare to get the interview. And then when she came out and hadn't gotten a job, I debriefed her, tried to figure out what she said wrong, and I was finally able to get that woman a job. It was a great relief. It was also one of the more humiliating things of my life, because I knew that she was our only hope to earn a living. And then it began for me. The end of my road was 3 years of hell. I like to remember before those 3 years, the little ugly things, the little humiliating things that I don't want repeated in my life. I like to remember when I was 18 years old and I was treated like a hero at our house, at home, because I had saved the house from burning down. What they didn't know, of course, was the mattress fire that I put out, I started. Passed out with a lit cigarette in my hand. Woke up to a burning couch in it and dragged it out. I don't want to forget the humiliation of knowing the truth. I don't want to forget my wedding night. We had a very romantic time a couple of weeks ago that I'll get a chance to tell you about in a little bit, but our wedding night was culminated by my throwing up on her at just the wrong time, right? There's romance for you. I don't want to forget the humiliation. I don't want to forget it. I don't want to forget the little ugly things that I hated happening, that I passed off with bravado and a smart-ass remark. And those 3 years, during them, I experienced hallucinations. Now, if you're new here, let me hasten to point out to you that the symptoms I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes are not requirements for membership. It's okay if you never had a hallucination, you know. You don't have to go out there and try it. And the thing for me that was difficult about hallucinations was not so much the frightening things that I occasionally saw or the auditory hallucinations that were threatening and frightening. It wasn't that so much. What really bothered me is that I knew that they put you away not for being crazy, but for acting crazy. And I was desperately trying to act sane. Now, the problem is that I never knew for sure if what you were seeing and hearing is the same thing that I was seeing and hearing. And it's very difficult to act sane under those circumstances. Like, for example, I used to get these phone calls. And it dawned on me after a while that only about half of them were real. But I heard the ring and I heard the voice, and so to defend myself against those strange looks that she began giving me, I got a little false case of hard of hearing. So if the phone rang, I watched to see if she heard it. If she did, then I'd run and get the phone, because there were lots of things going on I didn't want her to know about. And so it was difficult. And a little incident happened when I was about 3 months sober between my sponsor and I that is, for me, the best example I know of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Simple little thing that probably nobody else in the meeting noticed. I was sitting next to my sponsor, and a huge black bug came flying right at me and then darted between my sponsor and I, and we ended up looking at each other. Well, I didn't say anything. First thing that was said, my sponsor said. He looked at me and he said, "It was really there, Jack." I didn't ask him. You know, I'd be damned if I'd ask him. I was relieved to hear it, but I didn't ask him. And it occurred to me that there isn't a psychiatrist or a therapist or a priest or a mother or a father or a husband or a wife perceptive enough to answer a question that hasn't been asked. There's really only one way you can do that. You have to have been there yourself. And that's what we've got. We have been there. If you're new, believe me, we have been there. Maybe not me personally, but somebody. I challenge you to test me. Go to a meeting and share that thought that you have that nobody else ever thought, or that emotion that you have experienced that nobody else ever had, or tell them what you did that nobody else has ever done. I guarantee you the guy sitting next to you or the woman across to you did it too, thought it or felt it, and they will share with you how they live through it. That is a power that no other, to use one of the current terms, modality of treatment can offer. We have been there. I love that one. We see a commercial down in Los Angeles, you probably see it here too. There's one modality of treatment that for $6,000 will make you sick when you drink. Don't you love it? I got sick when I drank all the time. The secret to that is drink more, you know, and then you don't get sick. Just once at the end. I love that. Anyway, we've been there. I paid all my dues. One night in Kansas City in an alley when three guys left me for dead. I was perfectly alcoholic. As I nearly died, I was thinking, I bet they thought I fought a good fight. Don't you love the arrogance? I would die for your approval, man. During those 2 years I talk about, all emotion left me. My friend Nat says that booze washes all the good out of us, and it washed the God out of me. I had been, as a young man, very serious spiritual seeker. When I was 18 years old, I read the Stoma Theologica by St. Thomas Aquinas, which is an attempt to prove by rational means the existence of God. What it proved to me is there is none. But I was seeking. And by the end of my drinking, I was no longer seeking. I knew for a fact that this was a designless, purposeless universe full of accidents. And I just happened to be one. I used to go to intellectual bars like the ski room that opens at 6 a.m. and find some great big Irish Catholic and say, "You believe in God?" And he'd say, "Of course I do." I'd say, "Is he a loving and merciful God?" He'd say, "Of course." I said, yeah, well, how are you going to explain to me war and disease and malformed children and bigotry, and poverty, disease? Where's your loving God? And then he would beat me up to prove there was a God. He did prove to me there was a power greater than myself, you know. I was an antagonistic intellectual atheist when I found you. I now define intellectual as someone who has been educated beyond his capacity. But then, see, it was a symptom of my disease. The most intellectual people I've ever met are in prison. And I believe their motives were the same as mine. If I could just figure out the nature of the cosmos of the human psyche, then maybe I could get some control and live my life. And I couldn't figure it out. And I kept seeking. And I couldn't find it. And so I drank and used and abused. And pretty soon, as I say, all the emotion had left me. The only emotion I felt for about a year or so before I got sober was contempt. I had nothing but contempt for you, for me, for every idea, ideal, or institution. There were no exceptions but for my four children. In my drunken, irresponsible, maudlin Irish fashion, I love my kids. And one night early in June in 1971, my four children, the youngest was 7, the oldest was 20, got together in the front room of my house. And they told me they didn't love me. They said they didn't love me, they didn't want me, and they didn't need me. And somewhere in our literature, spirituality is described as being loved, wanted, and needed. And on that night, my alcoholism had successfully made it possible for nobody on the face of this earth to love, want, or need me. I felt lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid. What else is new? And I stood outside the front door of that little house with a suitcase that my kids had packed for me. They told me to get out of their lives. They begged me to leave their mother alone. I was killing her. And I stood out there with my suitcase and felt contempt for my children. After all I had done for them. And I got drunk. What else do you do? I didn't know what else to do. And I drank that day, and I drank that night. And then I called my wife, and I begged her like a child. I was 40 then, to take me back and give me another chance. She'd been giving me 17 years of other chances. I had humiliated her and hurt her in every way I knew possible. And she gave me another chance. So I came home. And I drank that day, and I drank that night. And then I picked a fight with her so I could get out to the bars. And I got to my little favorite bar there where I always got my mail. I was supposed to call me there first and then see if I was home. My wife used to say, I'd come home at 3 o'clock in the morning, and she'd say, well, why did you come home? So this is the only place open. So I went to my little bar, and I picked up a little girl about the age of my oldest daughter. And by the route we were taking, apparently we were going back to my house. I think I was going to introduce my wife to her replacement. I was a nice guy. I didn't get there, though, because I got arrested again. Now, I've been arrested a lot of times before, but I have to tell you that that particular arrest was a bum rap. it was a false phony arrest. Never should have happened. Really, I'm serious. You don't know, I mean, it shouldn't have been. Well, all that happened was that my extreme caution while driving drew the attention of the heat to me that night. I sat through 3 green lights waiting for the right one. They thought that was strange. They pulled me over and they busted me. Now, I had been searching through varieties of religions, philosophies, psychedelics. I used to do acid, mescaline, psilocybin, then get stoned and then get drunk for religious reasons. And I never could figure out what was wrong with me. And those 2 young members of the LAPD were able to figure it out on first glance. They arrested me for drunk, which is what I was and what I am. Now, I hope you like the suit that I wore tonight. Can I have a hand for the suit? Thank you. Because I was not dressed then the way I am tonight. I looked a little different. My eyes were sunk deep in my head. I saw those eyes yesterday when I went to court for a baby of mine who had 2.5 years of sobriety and decided he could get away with a little grass and then decided he would sell a little and then decided he needed to rob to get some more. And he's been in jail a month. And I sat in court and watched him set the trial date. And his eyes were sunk in his head. He was scared. He was feeling lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid. I knew those eyes. They were mine in 1971. My hair hung down to my shoulders. I was wearing a Fu Manchu mustache, flounce shirts, brocade bells, and a shoulder bag. Honey, I was hip. Proudest moment of my life was a few weeks earlier than that when I was standing in a corner in San Francisco, stoned to my eyeballs, and some dude drove by and said, "Are you the heroin man?" I said, "No, he's on the next corner, baby." I managed to get word out to a street kid that was watching the bust so that he could call my wife. I antagonized the arresting officers. And when I got to the jail, I antagonized the jailer. I wasn't too tactful. I made fun of his name, and he didn't think it was funny. He showed me the pearl-handled pistol that he wore. He kept me standing in a receiving cell for 1.5 hours. I kept telling him I have to go to the bathroom. He kept saying, "Go ahead." I demanded a phone call. "You got rights. I'm a revolutionary." So he let me make a phone call. It was 3 a.m. and I called New York City and he didn't think that was funny. So when my wife, who didn't know any better, came down to bail me out, he lost me. They had a little argument out there in the front of the jail. She said, "I'm here to bail out my husband, Jack Kissel." She said, "He's here." And he said, no, "I don't think he's in this jail." She said, "No, I know he's here." One of the, she didn't know how to describe my friends. One of those people told me that he's here. He said, "Lady, I don't think he's in this jail." She said, "Yes, he's here. That's his purse." Well, he still wouldn't bail me out. He sent her home. By then it was about 4:30. And he gave me a kick out at 5:30. That night in that jail was the ugliest night of my life. I felt abandoned, hopeless, incomprehensible demoralization. I watched the boy get raped in that drunk cell that night and couldn't do anything about it and didn't really give a damn. And I stared through the bars in a desperate effort to take a vacation, to blank out my mind, to empty my mind. It is my belief that that night in that jail cell, for an instant, I emptied of myself, of me, long enough to start the process. There is no better explanation for me. The next morning, he gave me a kick out at 5:30, and I called my wife. We had one of our usual conversations. I said, "Where the hell were you?" She said, "I was there. I'll come right down and pick you up." And I said, "Don't bother, I'll walk," and I hung up on her. I don't know why I called her. I guess just to make her feel bad. And I stumbled and staggered, stopped on the way to get well. And when I got home, it was 8 o'clock, and Jean said that the kids were right. I never should have let you back, and I won't again. Be gone by noon. And if you're here when I get home at noon, I will have you ejected. And she went to work. And I felt lonely, separate, different, angry, and afraid. I reached under the kitchen sink and got a bottle of white wine, and I smoked a little boo and drank my wine and passed out in the bed. Nothing else is new. Jean went to work, and for the first time in 17 years, a new thought occurred to her, and she grabbed the telephone book and looked up alcoholism. And she talked to a woman and told her a little bit about what we laughingly called our relationship. And the woman said, "It sounds to me like you're married not to a crazy man or even to a rotten son of a bitch. It sounds to me like you're married to a man with a disease, a physiological, pharmacological, diagnosable disease for which there is help," and told her what to do. And Jean came home, and I was lying on the bed, not bothering anybody. My eyeballs was yellow because my liver was failing, and she had trouble getting me awake, and by the time she did, she was crying. And I've seen my wife cry many times. I've seen her cry in pain, rage, fear, frustration. She was crying the night she tried to put a butcher knife through my stomach in front of our four kids, and I raised my hand and said, "Go ahead, do it. You'll be doing us both a favor." But she couldn't. I didn't understand the nature of her tears until months later, sober, I realized that she was crying that day out of compassion, because as she tried to get me awake, it dawned on her that I was dying of a disease I never chose to have. And she blurted out what they had told her to say. She said, "Jack, you're sick." Well, I knew that. "Man, you've been through the 3 days I've been through, and you'd be sick too. I just got out of jail." And she said, "Let me get you help." And I said, "Go ahead." I didn't ask what kind. Who cares? Now, that morning, I had exhibited a good deal of willpower and strength of character. Any real alcoholic in the room will know when I tell you that I had reserved a half a glass of white wine out of that bottle for when I wake up. That takes willpower. I didn't drink it. She went to call for help. I didn't know what kind. I didn't care. And I didn't drink it. I don't know why. Instead, I followed her to the telephone. And by then, she had a kind of confused look on her face, and she handed the phone to me, and she said, "He wants to talk to you." Well, that surprised me, too. Nobody wanted to talk to me in those days. I grabbed that phone, and this guy said, "Hi, my name is Bud. I'm an alcoholic. Can I help you?" And I haven't had a drink since that day. That was 11 years ago, last Sunday. That, it began for me then. He asked me to come see him, and my wife and I did, and he sat us down and told us what it used to be like, what happened, and what it was like then for him. He was a year and a half sober then. He's still sober because he's still trying to share this program. And that day he shared it with me. And I bought it, and I tried it, and it works. I have to tell you, and time is running close on me here, a little about what it's like now. I guess the best way I can tell you some of the many beautiful things that have happened to us has to do with my son and my... There are stories for each of my two girls, but I'll just tell you this one. Because it's current. When I got sober, my son was 12 and he's not an alcoholic. But my disease had damaged him a lot. He was a seclusive, reclusive, compulsive thief. He used to lock himself in his bedroom and then lock himself in his closet and then climb up on a shelf and cover himself with a blanket when he was 12. The night before I got sober, he hid in the front room of our house in the dark for 2 hours with a ball bat in his hands in the dark, waiting for me to come home. Fortunately for me, I got arrested that night. I was a year and a half sober before he could stay in the same room with me comfortably. When Gene went to Al-Anon and I went to AA, we became a team for the first time in our lives, and one of the first things we ever did as a team was send our kids to Alateen, whether they liked it or not. And John didn't like it, but we made him go, and then he came to like it. And after I had been sober a little better than 8 years, John, who had some trouble in school, he was unable, he finished high school after some difficulty, and then he wanted to go to college, and he went to Glendale Community College, and he flunked out, and then he got a job at Pickwick Bookstore and worked himself up to assistant manager, and then tried school again, and he went to Los Angeles Community College, and then he finally got, he completed those 2 years, and it was then 8 years of his work in Alateen and me working in AA. And as a gift to me, my son came to me and said, "You know, I know it's not possible, but if it were, I would go to Notre Dame the way you did." And there are things that happen in our sobriety that newcomers call coincidence, and some of the more elegant writers are calling synchronicity. Most of us call it miracle. One of those coincidences, my mother still lives in South Bend, and she had sent me a little clipping about my friend, my best friend in the seminary when I was 14. And he had gone on to become a priest, and this little newspaper clipping announced that he had been made assistant provincial of the Holy Cross Order. That's number 2 man in the organization that owns and runs Notre Dame. So after 33 years of not talking to him, I called him. His name happens to be Jack, too, and he was delighted to hear from me. He said, "Gee, what have you been up to all these years?" Well, I didn't go into a lot of detail. What I said to him is, "I guess the most significant thing is that I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 8 years." And he said, "Gee, that's great. I've been sober 10 years. He said, "Remember Father John used to take care of us in the seminary? He's got 9 years and he's doing pretty good." And those two men got together and made recommendations for my son. I have one of the letters at home that is, according to the principles of our program, rigorously honest. It says, you may find that this boy's grades are not what we would normally expect of a junior transfer, but we believe he has since found himself. And I am recommending that you accept him for transfer. And then, being a good Elk, he knows how to put a little pressure on. He signed it with his full title, Fellow and Trustee of the University. And 3 weeks ago Sunday, my wife and I went to Notre Dame to watch him graduate. Thirty years after I had graduated from there, my friend Jack and I went to an AA meeting, and Father John led it. And John introduced Gene and I proudly to his professors. And I remembered when he was in Little League denying that I was his father. By the grace of God and this program, gifts like that have come to me. I got to tell you one last thing. When I came here, there were two things when I was new that I absolutely could not get over. One of them I liked. One of them were the huge and gentle eyes that I saw. See, I couldn't listen to any of the intellectuals that I met in this fellowship because I figured I was smarter than them. The only people I could pay any attention to were the ones who had not been to the right universities, but the ones who had been to the right prisons. And three of those guys adopted me, Sam and Johnny and Fred, my sponsor. And each of them had huge and gentle eyes. And they would walk up to me and they'd say, everything's going to be all right. And it felt like I had taken a drink. They had to tell me pretty often because I drank a lot, you know, but it worked for me, those huge and gentle eyes. The other thing that I really didn't like was that when I was new, you just couldn't seem to keep your hands off of me. And I'm a very private person. And you were always hugging me and patting me and putting your arm around me and kissing me, and God, it made me nervous. I'd sit next to my sponsor and he'd put his arm around me and I'd be sure everybody got the wrong idea. And I now know that that is the beginning of the healing process. When a sober member puts their hands on one who wants to be, it is the beginning. I love to watch it when somebody brings their new one in with their arm. You got a good hold on them and they sit them down. And everybody in the neighborhood touches them, you know, and they push them and pat them. Somebody goes and gets them a half a cup of coffee because we've been there. And I know they hate it. And I know that that's the beginning of the healing process. And one night when I was sitting in a meeting, Bill Allison, who has 35 years, God love him, found some words that describe for me my beginnings in AA, those huge and gentle eyes and those soft and loving hands. And I just want to leave you with those. They are, through the hands of such as these, God speaks. And behind their eyes, He smiles upon the earth. Thank you.